For years, Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Through deeply reported, narrative-driven stories, we're digging into the myths, scandals, and power structures that still shape the South, and in a lot of ways, the country itself. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.
Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. Today, let's talk about the ends of eras. It seemed like we were in our end of the era when several trends emerged all at once. Late night television may be dead. Gen Z doesn't drink alcohol, which may change lifestyles forever. And one would think that would interfere with our summer cruising era, although that one may be premature. Anyway, let's start with late-night TV and Vanita Socker on WCCO in Minneapolis.
We're talking a little TV with Matt Rausch with TVInsider.com. So let's talk a little bit about this Colbert show. Thursday, the final show. What is happening with late-night TV? What do you see happening?
Well, it does feel like it's somewhat under assault these days, just because of the fact that CBS is giving up the franchise, and over on ABC, Jimmy Kimmel, if you remember at the beginning of the season back in September, he was taken off the air for a week after a kerfuffle with the FCC and the current administration, of course, who's still calling for his firing. Throw the bum out, basically, is the attitude of the administration, because, of course, they don't like the fact that most of these shows, especially on the networks, are making hay of politics, which is, of course, their bread and butter, especially when you're talking about Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Kimmel in particular. But yeah, with the show going off the air, I'm still in shock about it. And you're watching these last episodes, and this is not a show that is feeling like it's on its last legs at all. I mean, everybody is still talking about Thursday night show, where David Letterman came back to the theater that he reopened so successfully in the 1990s and ran it up until the time he passed the baton to Stephen Colbert. And they, you know, throwing CBS furniture off the rooftop onto the CBS eye, and, you know, poking the network in the eye, for of course, but also at one point as sitting in the audience. So, you know, the, David Letterman, you know, flipped late night television on its head, both at NBC and CBS. But now this is going dark. They're turning the time period over to a syndicated show by Byron Allen, really diminishing once again the whole idea of network television in many regards. Theater that goes all the way back to the days of Ed Sullivan, and they're just letting it go dark. It really just seems so incredibly dispiriting in many ways. There's a fellowship among the late night hosts, and I think they see themselves as the last bastion of a great grand TV tradition, and to have one of them go away, it's pretty serious.
It was fun to see that. I just said the hilarious to see them all together. So with all the season finales coming up, you talked about late night TV. What do you have your eye on as far as season finales?
Well, this is the last days of the traditional TV season, and I think the biggest one on network right now will be this finale on Wednesday of Survivor, which is celebrating its 50th season, and that's been a pretty historic season for them, and there's a lot of, you know, fan involvement in terms of how this season was even structured, and so I think in that regards, that's the biggest one of this week on regular primetime. Pretty much the season has gone dark, but there's so many fewer shows on regular television. It's become this patchwork of game shows and reality shows and scripted franchises. So you've got like a full night of Chicago shows, a full night of Law and Order shows, a full night of NCIS shows, and it all feels like there's so much sameness going on. I think that, though, what's happening in late night is just really significant, though, in terms of the way that broadcast network TV just feels like it's diminished in a world where streaming has become so huge. In terms of finales right now, also on Wednesday, we have the finale of this superhero show called The Boys on Amazon Prime Video that's made so much noise over the years, and I think that's stealing some of the thunder from what's happening on broadcast television, because so many people are talking about the streaming shows. But there was a show called Paradise that came on recently on Hulu, and it reminded me a lot of Lost, and it made me think, if Lost was created today, it probably would not be airing on ABC. It'd probably be airing on Hulu, and that's the way that the network, that's the way that the TV industry is going. Anything that's really interesting and out of the box tends to go on streaming and not on broadcast television. And by losing Colbert this week, it is just one more sign that the networks are becoming less I think, relevant to the conversation about what's happening on TV.
I think you're spot on. You can read the Worth Watching column at TVInsider.com.
The cocktail era could end if Gen Z has its way. Here's more with Newell Normand at WWL in New Orleans.
They have been called the dry generation, but is that, in fact, the case? Julian Braithwaite, CEO of the International Alliance for Responsible Drinking. So let's jump right into this and talk about you guys have engaged upon some new research about Americans and their drinking habits, more specifically this summer. What does the study reveal?
So we wanted to really look and see whether American drinking patterns were changing, whether Americans were drinking differently, particularly as we head into the summer. You know, we've got the Memorial Day weekend, we've got the big sporting events coming up, we've got the World Cup, which is going to be a huge thing this summer. And we wanted to understand how Americans were looking at this as they headed into the summer. And what comes across is that, you know, 9 out of 10 Americans who drink are planning to drink this summer. So far, perhaps so unsurprising. But the other thing that comes across really strongly in this data is just how intentional Americans are planning to be about it. With over 60% of Americans saying that actually drinking in moderation this summer is going to be important.
It's Sophia with an F, Franklin with a Y, and if you're looking for some bubblegum dum-dum podcast, then you are in the wrong place, baby. Whether I'm reminiscing on the trials and tribulations of working in the corporate world to recapping today's latest reality TV show, you're going to want to pull up a chair and stick around. It's a good time and always 100% unfiltered. Follow and listen to Sophia with an F wherever you get your podcasts.
For them.
So let's talk about that. Define moderation.
Right. So moderation is, I mean, it's a practice, really. It's about a number of practical things that people do. It's about alternating drinking alcohol with non-alcoholic products. It's about staying hydrated. It's about knowing your limits. It's about not drinking every night of the week. It's about drinking, eating before you drink or eating while drinking. It's a whole series of behaviors that add up to moderation. And what we've seen in the data is that people, particularly young people, are sort of rediscovering these practices of moderation in new ways and calling them new things.
So one of the names that's out there, and I've not heard this, pacing, you know, to pace to drink is called, what is it, zebra striping?
So, right. So one of the things we've been seeing from the survey that comes out in the responses is, particularly from Gen Z, is something called zebra striping, or what you would call on this side of the Atlantic, zebra striping, which is, you know, it's going back to this old habit of alternating alcoholic drinks and non-alcoholic drinks and staying hydrated. But of course, there are more choices for doing that now, with people able to go out for a beer with their friends and then follow up with a non-alcoholic beer with one of these zero beers that are out there now. So very much a new way of looking at something that's always been true in terms of moderation.
So, Julian, this has truly become more about taste. Like, I'm a wine drinker, and I'm always very cognizant. You know, I drink a glass, and then I always have water with it to make sure that I'm hydrated, because I just truly enjoy the taste of wine, especially with food. And I typically drink it paired with food. Are we seeing that more and more with the whole lineage of alcoholic drinks?
So this is another, you know, this is another thing that came across in the survey, which was interesting, which is, you know, drinking over a meal, drinking with food has always been a really important part of drinking moderately and drinking well. But Gen Z have discovered a new phrase for it, which is called nonamaxing. And nonamaxing is when you drink with friends or with family over a meal, over food. And you may do it at home, you may do it out. But it is the practice of drinking over a meal. And that, of course, nonna is the Italian for grandmother, and it actually refers to a form of drinking that, you know, the Italians have been practicing for, you know, many generations, but it is at its heart drinking in moderation, which is drinking over food, drinking with friends, socializing in a way where alcohol is part of the occasion, but it doesn't define it.
These were mostly European cultures, right, that seem to be permeating more and more throughout the United States.
So this is true. I mean, you see this in Southern Europe, as you say, particularly in the wine-growing countries of Southern Europe, and the Italians, you know, epitomize it. And I think that's why it's called non-amaxing over here in the U.S. But it's part of this trend we've been seeing and that comes over in the survey, which is about drinking more intentionally, about drinking being part of an occasion or an experience but not defining it. And this idea that, you know, you drink over a meal with friends, part of socializing, part of enjoying alcohol, but in moderation and in good company, and over good food, that is something that, you know, has deep roots in European culture, but it is something that's being given a new twist here over in America.
Now, I have to imagine there are some external influences, right? Social media and people put themselves out there doing certain things. You have potential employers checking it. Yeah, peer pressure. There's really a whole thought moderation that's going on about the role that alcohol should play in one's life. You have the health concerns along there. But still, it comes back, at least for me, it comes back to taste. I mean, I never did drink just for the sake of drinking. I stuck to those types of alcoholic consumption that I enjoyed, that it was all about the taste. And it seems like we're seeing more of that.
Yeah, taste is still really important. That comes over in this survey as well. And I think a couple of things are going on. One is that actually people can still, you know, pursue the taste of their favorite beer or cocktail, but they can do so with a zero alcohol or a low alcohol alternative. But it's also this idea that, you know, you should do so more intentionally and be in control. And that doesn't mean that people are not drinking or that people are feeling necessarily under pressure from friends to go out drinking, or, you know, what comes across really strongly in this survey is how people want to make up their own mind, have their own choices about how to drink. Over 90% of Americans say that being self-directed about how they drink, not being under peer pressure either from friends or anyone else, is really important for them. And that is perhaps a shift in mindset or even a shift in culture from at least the days when I was young, when you'd go out and, you know, how you drank was a sort of function of who you were drinking with, and you'd go and buy rounds in the pub. Those trends seem to be over, or at least changed quite a lot, and people are now much more directional and intentional about how they choose to drink.
Unlimited drinks are a common addition to a vacation cruise, and it turns out the risk of hantavirus and tight finances and everything else is not stopping us from cruising. Here's KCBS in San Francisco.
With airfares soaring due to rising fuel costs, cruises are turning out to be a popular bet for vacationers this year. This despite outbreaks of highly publicized hantavirus and norovirus on board some ships. Joining us live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline this morning, CBS News travel editor Peter Greenberg. Peter, let's cut right to the chase here. Despite these virus outbreaks, cruises are still safe overall, right?
Very much so. In fact, you may remember during COVID, there was an all-stop order from the Centers for Disease Control, which stopped cruising for 18 months, while all the cruise lines had to comply with about 75 different protocols of public health, ranging from ventilation, social distancing, food preparation, and many other things, and they all complied. And as a result, the outbreaks of norovirus, which is pretty, you know, was pretty common at that point, have been mitigated substantially.
Cruise bookings are up as we head into the summer travel season. Is that because airfares are so high with the fuel costs rising?
Well, not necessarily, because cruise bookings tend to take place way in advance. A lot of cruise bookings were done 6 months ago, 7 months ago, before the Iran conflict and the fuel prices started to skyrocket. But they remain strong simply because the prices have not increased. And not only that, there are more ships out there with higher capacity to allow for those itineraries to happen.
Could rising gas prices in the U.S. be pulling travelers away from road trips, looking for alternatives, and they say, hey, maybe cruising is a great idea?
Well, believe it or not, we're so addicted to our cars that even with $7 a gallon gas, which I just happened to be in Los Angeles last week, we're still in our cars and we're still going to go. The difference is going to be this. Every year you'll see reports from AAA saying about how many cars will be on the road for Memorial Day, Labor Day, July 4th, etc. What they're not really telling you is how many people are going to be in each car. And the more the gas prices rise, the more the cars become like a clown car, and everybody's going to jump in to be able to amortize those costs. But it's not going to stop us from driving.
Are there some good cruise deals to be found for people looking in that direction?
A lot of good deals, especially in the Caribbean this summer, which is typically their off-season. Alaska's going very, very strong, so you'll find less of a deal there. But you look at Caribbean, the Eastern Med, the answer is yes. And you'll see more and more of that as we get closer to June.
Hey, Peter, I want to jump back to air travel for a moment. Airfares are sky high because of the fuel costs. Is that reducing the load? Are there any bargains to be found, maybe if you want to use points or miles?
Well, there are a few bargains we found in terms of airfares, but there's been a drop in incoming travel for foreigners, as well as a drop from outgoing passengers from America. And so for the first time in recent memory, we're seeing availability of frequent flyer reward seats, and in some cases, at lower levels of redemption. Now, this is not going to extend for a long period of time. They're sort of like pop-up sales, but the good news is we're starting to see that, and when you see it, jump on it, because it may not last forever.
I mean, I don't know if you can pull this out of thin air, but any miles bargains that you can tell us about?
I found one the other day from New York to Johannesburg, a trip that would normally be about 120,000 miles. It was going for 80, and on one way it was going for 40. That's a substantial drop.
When they drink intentionally, Gen Z calls it nona-maxing. But what will they call travel when the prices are high and there's a chance to tack a vacation onto a business trip? Let's start with pleasure. Here's Rob Hart on Noon Business Hour.
More business travelers are turning work trips into family vacations, and experts say with the right planning, it can provide an affordable vacation option, especially if navigated properly. Joining us with some key advice is Angie Rice, co-founder of Boutique Travel Advisors based in Scottsdale, the website travelbta.com. Angie, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. And I've heard of this before, this concept of bleisure travel, where one of the parents has a work conference scheduled for Orlando, and that turns into a family vacation at Disney World. Is that the most common iteration of bleisure travel?
Right. This opportunity to really combine business with pleasure, work hard, play hard, right?
And what are some of the ways in which you can do it properly where the work can be done, the pleasure can be accomplished, and maybe you can get your employer to pick up some of the tab?
Well, I think this trend is growing, and it's growing because we have more people working virtually, which means teams have to come together, and geography plays a part when you bring teams together. And companies understand the real reality. If they're choosing these destinations that are advantageous for vacations, that there's almost this opportunity to welcome families in some capacity. So we've seen retreats being taking place like places like Disney in ski towns when it's in the off season. And it really lends itself for a nice hybrid where the employer, you know, supports the business agenda for the employees, but they do allow some grace for families to join and also to extend at their own expense.
And what are some smart scheduling? What's some smart scheduling that your family can do to make sure that everyone gets the most out of this trip?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand whether it's going to be a distraction to be attending and being on location the same time the family member who is attending the work event. So sometimes it might be a stagger where if it's an intensive situation where they have to buckle down and work long hours, you might have the traveler that's also working go for 2 days and then have the family meet up. So you really want to make sure that you're not inconveniencing or creating a conflict. You want it to be supported. So really recognize and bring it up. You know, it really should be a discussion that the employer shares with the employees, that they understand that we're welcoming the families, or if it's just an opportunity to take advantage of the fact that you've got this flight paid for work and the family meets you at the end of the trip, and just clarifying that it's okay to still expense the cost of the airfare, even if your date to return home is extended due to the family trip being part of the equation.
And also, it seems like there's the right way and the wrong way to combine business with pleasure, because maybe you can turn a conference where you go to a couple of seminars and maybe see a celebrity guest speaker. That's a pretty good
opportunity for a family vacation. But if it's a high-level negotiation or if you're closing a deal, you don't want to think about those reservations you have at the Hoop-Dee-Doo review at Disney World.
Yeah, we actually consult with employers on this issue, small businesses, larger businesses, and really set the messaging. The messaging has to be very clear. Is this an opportunity for the families to join? And are you going to have separate curriculum and an itinerary for the families versus the employees so that the employees aren't disrupted, right? We don't want to create disruption either way. You don't want kids joining you at Disney and realizing dad or mom isn't accessible. Or on the flip side, they respect the fact that dad or mom isn't accessible and they're joining a group of other families to enjoy the fun with the other parent. So you just really have to set the expectations between the employer and the employee to ensure that it's value added for the employer and the employee, as well as the family that's enjoying. It's a great opportunity. I personally joined my husband not too long ago on a trip up to Alberta, Canada. It was kind of something on my bucket list. He had a conference there, so I squeezed my way into joining him. But at the same time, I knew that he wasn't going to be accessible to me, so I did a lot of things self-guided. If it was a family trip, I might have extended the trip and had the, you know, myself and the kids arrive later, so it didn't disrupt my husband's agenda as it related to his work.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Berry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
Understanding power requires more than headlines. I'm Peter Hamby, host of The Powers That Be, a podcast from Puck examining politics, economics, and media to provide context, analysis, and clarity without sensationalism. We ask how power operates, who benefits, and what's at stake. If you want to move beyond breaking news to deeper understanding, join us on The Powers That Be. New episodes every weekday. Follow The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.